From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Sweet tea. It's a Southern thing. Don't try to understand.
There's a good reason why I don't drink sweet tea. You know, it's because I'm an adult and I don't need brown Kool-Aid. That's why. I'm a grown up and I can drink something bitter once in a while without going, I need a Jolly Rancher to swizzle in it. Too bitter.
We bet you learn a thing or two about the nectar of the South later on today's show. First, though, that stand-up bit reminds me of yesterday's show. We met three comedians, Cliff Cash, Tom Simmons, and Stuart Huff. They've created the Sick of Stupid comedy tour to help debunk stereotypes about racism, sexism, and antiquated political beliefs in the South. Here's a sample of Cliff Cash's stand-up act.
Lord, I just want to thank you for Kim Davis in Kentucky, Lord, that she was able to just keep laser focused on what's truly important. That despite 21,000 children dying every day of starvation, Kim is able to really stay on track for your work, Lord, which is keeping people who love each other from having marital rights.
Well, the mission of the Sick of Stupid tour and the name of the tour did not sit well with some of you. Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Radford Bunker. How absolutely ludicrous that you would use something called the Stupid Tour, to make fun of people's firmly held religious and political beliefs. If they were making fun of liberals or any other religion besides Christianity, you would have a frickin' cow.
Good morning. Misters Cash, Simmons, and Huff aren't doing a Sick of Stupid Southern Humor Tour. They're a bunch of leftists just promoting the gay agenda and attacking the Christian faith.
We always love to get your opinions. If you disagree with the guests on our show, let us know. We do prefer it if you leave your name and what city you're in. We don't often like to use anonymous comments. So call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message for us. Find us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. You know, most people think music when they hear the word punk, but punk is also about a sort of do-it-yourself DIY lifestyle and aesthetic. Punks in the 90s often made their own clothes, they repaired their own bikes and grew their own vegetables, and made their own magazines. Zines are self-published, handmade magazines, and they're still around today, not so much in handmade form, in a tangible form, but often in online form. And there will be plenty on display this weekend as the fourth annual Atlanta Zine Fest kicks off. This year's theme is digital DIY. Amanda Mills is the organizer of the Atlanta Zine Fest, and she's executive director of Murmur Media. Good morning, Amanda.
Hi, good
Did
morning.
I just pronounce Murmur?
Murmur, yeah.
Murmur yeah. Media. So do you remember the first zine you ever read?
Actually, yeah, I was at Criminal Records back when it was what is now Stratosphere, and my mom would take me there every weekend so that she could look at all the CDs, but I was much more interested in the zines.
And they had, like, oftentimes record stores had big bins full of different zines.
Yeah, I mean, I always had been into reading and writing and would keep a journal, and so I was just, like, naturally drawn to them because they looked so handmade, you know, in somebody's bedroom, which I'm sure they were. And so it sort of opened up like a world of possibility for me to engage in something like that.
So when did you make your first zine?
Immediately after finding zines. I was in fifth grade. My mom was a secretary, and she's always been really supportive of any of my interests. And so I would, you know, make little zines at home or with my friends collaboratively, and she would go to work and copy them for us. And she filled that role until, like, I was in college. Just,
well,
like, using her office
mother.
To, yeah. Make my zines.
So tell, I mean, for people who have never seen a zine or picked one up, what does a zine look like?
So I guess the most classic zine is a sheet of computer paper folded in half and stapled. And they're normally not more than, you know, you can only fit so many sheets through a staple. So it's basically, like, maybe 10 pages total, folded in half into a little booklet. But a lot of people sort of run with that and can do different sculptural things with folding. And I've even seen, like, letterpress zines. There's a resurgence in art zines, people using zines to distribute their artwork because it's more accessible and cheap, more cheaply done.
So what makes a zine a good zine?
Oh, that's a good question. Honestly, I try to stay out of those sort of conversations just because I view myself as an organizer, but I certainly have my own opinions.
Well, I mean, you've been reading zines for decades now.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, that's true. I feel like, okay, one, I wrote a piece about this on Arts ATL also. I feel like commercialism doesn't have a role in zine making. That's sort of the one like line that I'll draw.
So no ads.
No ads. And I do think that with guerrilla marketing nowadays, people turn to zines because they look so cool and are kind of sexy and are a way to maybe get people to pay attention to a certain product without them maybe realizing it. So it's not so overt. But to me, that's completely undoing the purpose of zines. And so, you know, it might look like a zine, but it's not. It's absolutely not.
If it's a commercial DIY venture. Look.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, I'm kind of saying the opposite because those zines look DIY, but they're not. And so it's sort of the aesthetic becomes something that can be capitalized on. And so I think in a classic way, zines look like they were made through collaging or like handwritten or cutting up text, and it's black and white because that's the cheapest way to like photocopy a zine. But then that aesthetic, if it's tethered to the medium too deeply, can be used sort of against it. So to me, furthering the conversation in ways that promote like experimentation and engaging in the media in different ways than are maybe more classic is a way of furthering the media and keeping it alive, because otherwise it can be sort of manipulated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amanda Mills, Executive Director of Murmur Media and organizer of the Atlanta Zine Fest. You don't make any money off of zines.
No, $0.
In fact, it usually costs you at least a little.
Absolutely, yeah.
So why make a zine?
It?
Yeah.
I think that like the commercial justification doesn't really have a place in zine making. Sometimes I hear people talk about zines as rough drafts, or they will bring up people such as Comet Bus, Aaron Comet Bus, who has a zine, Comet Bus, that has been turned into a book that you can buy, you know, at a place like Barnes & Noble, and sort of point to that as a possible success. And
that would mean that they're kind of like, you know, when you're walking around and somebody hands you their demo CD.
And in that way, it gets framed as like a stepping stone. I don't personally view it that way. It absolutely can be engaged that way. That's not precluded. But I don't think the conversation ends there with zines are just part of a process.
Because some people do it for years and years
absolutely.
And years.
Yeah. And, to me, it's more about, it's about a myriad things. Like, first of all, I think that every zine is an artifact, and in an archival sense gives a glimpse into that person's lifestyle and opinions that might not otherwise be captured. I think that people who are underrepresented in mainstream media often turn to zines. I think that making a zine is a political act, even if it's about unicorns. It doesn't really matter. The fact that people are engaging in creating something creatively and they're doing it themselves is very empowering. And it's not just creating the actual zine. It's also creating channels of distribution, such as online distros or utilizing message boards or even just passing it out at a party or while you're on tour. You know, it's next to the albums that you're selling. It's also about the conversations and the communities that happen surrounding zines because, like I said, a lot of the content isn't represented in mainstream media. And so it's a way for people to sort of have conversations on a larger scale that they might not otherwise have access to. And that's how it was for me.
So do you think that the digital world has helped make zines better or not? I mean, because I remember walking around LA and that's what the way you were talking about earlier, those little pamphlets, they'd be all over the place.
Absolutely.
But now you find zines online.
Yeah.
I mean, and you never touch a piece of paper.
There's a archive called the Queer Zine Project, QZP, and they scan in, or I think you can also scan in yourself and send it to them, any zine that is related to or made by the queer community. And it's available online. And you can also print it out. And that's a really powerful thing because when it comes to marginalized people, there's often a violent effort to erase them. So in this way, it's being captured and, you know, kind of available in a more permanent way online, but it has a relationship still to the printed version, and because it's like these scanned in copies. Yeah. When I'm like trying to motivate people to make zines, I always argue that we're constantly creating content, you know, via Facebook and other social media. Blogs are obviously like a relation to zines, even text messages, and to just sort of like mine all of the content that you're already creating. And that's a good place to start when you're making a zine. So in that sense, I think that there's a digital and print relationship there too.
So how many stacks of paper do you have in your house?
I know, seriously, like I'm made out of paper. I'm also a like paper hoarder, like little scraps that like friends leave of notes or something like that. I have everything from my whole life.
But when I look, you handed me a schedule of the Atlanta Zine Fest, and this year's is the fourth.
Yes.
This isn't just about writing zines.
No. Yeah, so the Zine Fest has always been organized around supporting, as I said before, the communities and conversations that happen around zines. And a lot of that is about underrepresented voices. It's about alternative media. It's about
doing it yourself.
And also like providing an opportunity for those connections and those networks and collaboration, discussion and learning. So it's kind of like just about making a space that creates that sort of community, more so than just being like, here's a zine, you know, and this is what a zine is.
Our own Emily Jones tweets this: as OST discusses zines, a reminder that my personal idol, Reggie Rocket, had her own. Reggie was a character on Rocket Power, which is Nickelodeon in the 90s.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, before people who've maybe they never even encountered the word zine,
right,
where would they start?
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess I would just start from within. I don't know if that's like
the... Well, would you suggest reading a zine first or writing something?
I would suggest writing something, absolutely. I think that the exposure to zines comes when you put your own zine out into the world, and that's like a really good way to interact with other people's zines. At Zine Fest, bartering is strongly encouraged, you know, bringing in your own stack of zines that you've made and doing it for trade. We operate on it's like somewhat an alternative to capitalism model, which is, you know, it's open to the public, anybody can come, we provide supplies, and basically this idea that you can just jump in no matter what and it's accessible to everyone.
That is Amanda Mills. She is executive director of Murmur Media and organizer of the Atlanta Zine Fest. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Certainly, if you have ever made a zine or you do end up making one, snap a screenshot of it and share it with us on Facebook or Twitter at OSD Talk. The fourth annual Atlanta Zine Fest kicks off tomorrow. It'll take place at different galleries along Broad Street in Atlanta, and you can get more information at gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought. My lover, so honey, let me hold you, let me love you forever. Oh, yeah. I'm Celeste Headlee. It is National Iced Tea Day, and surely you know that iced tea in the South shouldn't be consumed without a good dental plan. Sweet tea has been a staple on Southern menus for more than 100 years. It's a simple beverage, and these days you can find it just about everywhere in Georgia. But there was a time when sweet tea was more rare. Let's pour ourselves a tall glass of history. Sweet tea.
Sweet tea really has remained a regional specialty. You cannot walk into most restaurants, unless there is a Southern restaurant, and find sweet tea on menus. My name is Tova Danovich, and I'm a freelance journalist. The first time I ever tried sweet tea was visiting my stepfather's family down in Florida. Growing up mostly on the West Coast and in the Midwest, it was not something that I had at all been exposed to.
You've got a good eye for tea. You think I can have some of that Lipton?
Come aboard.
Well, that Lipton sure looks good.
Good? It's dandy tasting. because of the quality.
I think those brisk Lipton iced teas were around, which are super sweetened, and so I, you know, could get those out of vending machines here and there, but finding it as something on a restaurant menu was really baffling to me. Tea has been drunk in the United States since the very earliest days of colonization. You start kind of seeing the price of black tea go down around the World War I period of time, which is not to say that that war actually affected the price of tea.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on six continents to save the homes and ideals of free men from Axis domination.
But World War II, because of the involvement of green tea specifically producing countries, you had a trade barrier that allowed black tea to actually take over from green tea. Until World War II, green and black tea were drank about equally, in equal measures throughout the United States. After World War II, black tea became immensely more popular, simply because people had switched over to drinking it during the war when it was the only tea that was readily available. And since then, Americans have continued to drink primarily black tea. We don't know exactly where it began. I believe the first known published recipe for sweet tea, as we would think of it today, is in an old Virginia housewife's cookbook.
After scalding the teapot, put into it 1 quart of boiling water and 2 teaspoonsful green tea. If wanted for supper, do this at breakfast. At dinner time, strain without stirring through a tea strainer into a pitcher.
But that isn't to say that people in other states weren't drinking sweet tea. And, you know, there may even be a small cookbook, self-published recipes traded back and forth that we have no ability to have records of today.
A squeeze of lemon will make this delicious and healthful, as it will correct the astringent tendency.
My name is Vernell Mosley, and I am a tea purveyor of Sweet Tea Factory. When I first started learning about tea, the fact that all tea comes from one plant blew me away.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me. 'Cause I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
Here it is. André Michaux, he was a French explorer and botanist. And in the mid-1700s to early 1800s, he was noted for actually importing the actual tea plant here and planting it in Somerville, South Carolina. There was some discrepancy about what was the first tea estate, whether it was the Bigelow Estate in Charleston or this particular estate in Somerville. Then we'll take credit for, you know, being the pioneer or the one who made the, you know, wonderful discovery of tea in the U.S.
'Cause I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
One of the members of the House of Representatives, as a joke, created a bill that said if you're a restaurant serving unsweet tea, you must serve sweet tea. You cannot just serve unsweet tea. And he wanted to make it law for the city of Atlanta. And I thought it was a great thing. That's because I'm biased. I'm a tea purveyor, so of course I'd want everyone to serve tea as well as sweet tea.
Every Sunday afternoon, we forget about our cares.
I'm Tyler Hobbs, and I'm from Indiana. I drank sweet tea growing up. My mom actually would brew it in the sun. She'd brew it in a big pitcher and set it out in the sun all day long.
Barbara Brockway, Atlanta. I'm a Yankee, so I never drank sweet tea. Growing up, I drink unsweet tea, still do.
Calvin Williamson, Atlanta, Georgia. I like sweet tea because it was something that I've always drank from early childhood on up to now. It's just, if you're born in the South, it's just what you drink. And the sweeter, the better. I mean, if you run out of syrup, you can pour it over your pancakes.
Rubbing elbows at the Ritz with those millionaires. When I take my sugar to tea,
time is ritzy. Sean Powers produced that story for us with help from Olivia Reingold and Jenna Stafford. For more on the history of sweet tea, visit gpbnews.org. When I take my sugar to tea. It's been a long week. We talked about the Roots reboot, Afrofuturism, and the best way to eat a Georgia oyster. Now it's time to sit back, relax, and celebrate that it's Friday. Let's head into the break room.
Open plan offices are literally killing people, and I work in one.
Hey!
Don't touch me!
He had faced a maximum of 14 years in the state penitentiary, but last week the judge chose a lesser sentence, in part because he feared anything longer would have a severe impact on Turner.
Hey, what are you burning, man? Come on.
It's everything. It's everything that reminds me of her, and I need it gone.
Joining us in the break room, Kathy Lord, journalist and former NPR correspondent. Tamika DePriest is a marketing and communications strategist. Amber Scott is executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. And Robbie Medwed is education director of the Southern Jewish Resource Network for Gender and Sexual Diversity and wins the long title award of the day. Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Well, it is always almost the weekend, but the day's not over yet, so there's still time to talk about work. Tech companies like Google and Facebook have made open office plans really popular. You see them everywhere now. They're cost-effective, and the intention, they say, is to increase collaboration and productivity among the workers. But do they work?
What you doing?
Working. Maybe you should, too.
Nah. Boop. Delete.
Turns out, open office plans might actually do more harm than good. A 2013 survey found nearly half of workers in open offices complained about the noise level and the lack of privacy, and researchers have concluded distractions actually cut productivity in half compared to those who work in private offices. So, fans and detractors from open offices plans, who here likes open office? Okay, so for our listeners, no hands went up. Okay, Tamika, you don't like them?
No, I don't like them for day-to-day, only really for creative brainstorming sessions or project planning
sessions. Couldn't that be done in a big meeting room?
With groups. No, I mean, so I like the whole idea of having open space where you can sort of write in multiple places, stick, you know, Post-its on the wall and, you know, sort of bring plans together in that way, play with some Play-Doh while you're doing it. You know, that speaks to the creative in me. However, the introspective aspect of my personality, when I'm doing a lot of researching, writing, thinking, I thrive on solitude and quiet space. And you know, it actually makes me think of the research around telecommuting and the level of productivity as it relates to those who work at home, tend to work more, longer hours and get more done.
Yeah.
That's me.
People are terrible. I have no desire to sit in a room with 30 other people typing on a computer and someone is
cranky McCrank.
Absolutely. And someone, you know, someone's going to bring fish for lunch. It always happens. Look, we can have offices, and when we want to talk in person, we can actually see each other or send a text message, and it's great.
Or someone forgot their headphones and
exactly
they have to listen to their music.
Right, and no one else's music is going to be good.
Well,
right.
In the radio business, which, you know, it was a problem being in those open offices.
Oh, my God, it's so loud.
It's so loud. You're trying to listen to tape, interview people, think, write, and it's almost impossible in that kind of environment.
Although,
I was very lucky to work a lot in a home office or on the road.
Although my beloved NPR headquarters in D.C., the new building is relatively open office.
I know.
Oh, my God. This is definitely something we would love to hear from our listeners about. So tell us, open office plans, yay or nay. In the meantime, let's move on to possibly the best part of the workday, lunch.
I am so hungry.
Then go make something.
I am so lazy.
Okay, if you're hungry but too lazy to leave your desk or your bed or your couch or wherever, Amazon has recently launched a free one-hour restaurant delivery service for Prime members in Atlanta. Members can order from more than 60 restaurants, and then you can track the delivery in real time. So look, here is my question. With all the different things that Amazon's offering, I begin to suspect that Amazon's final plan is to just make it so that we never leave our homes.
Not so... I'm actually kind of okay with that. I'm kind of not, and I'm kind of okay with that.
Well, you're cranky McCranker.
I am cranky, and everything that doesn't make me put on pants is going to be a good idea, but at a certain point...
Thank you for wearing them today.
You're welcome. I know that I have to see people in person. I have friends in New York who legitimately had a conversation of how long it was okay to sit in their apartments and get everything delivered or sent out. And they decided that 2 weeks was the limit.
Oh, wow.
Two weeks. That's
Holy
just
cow.
Absurd.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks is a bit much, but I'm from Boston originally, and I really do miss that you get so much delivered to you, and you don't always have to kind of get in your car and drive somewhere. Like, it's nice to be able to just be a Friday night and be like, you know what, I don't feel like leaving my house today.
I think it's a great idea.
Really?
And, you know, Uber Eats has this, too.
Yes.
This is very similar. But unfortunately, this delivery service doesn't deliver to my zip code yet.
Oh, see, but so, you checked.
I did check.
I think it's a great idea. I think Amazon is also delivering groceries
they are.
In London. But, you know, anything they can do to move that profit margin, which they've been struggling with over, you know, a few years now, from the red to the black, while helping us as well, I think it bodes well.
All right, since we're on the topic of food, remember there have been cronuts, chia seeds, kale, cupcakes, all food fads. The next big culinary trend may have to do with the color black. You got your little black dress, now you can have your little black meal. There is ice cream that's made with coconut ash, pure black ice cream, black pasta, black hot dog and hamburger buns. And if you looked, I don't know if you guys looked at the pictures of all the black food, does it look delicious?
No.
No.
Does it look delicious?
It doesn't look delicious. And then I keep thinking about ash.
I don't know that I want that in my food.
I don't know. I love smoky food. I mean, I'll go to a bar and literally they will put smoke into my drink. I would definitely try the coconut ash ice cream, but there's something about a black hamburger bun with squid ink and all those other things that just is not appealing in the slightest.
No, nobody.
Yeah. Chocolate cake. I actually went to a wedding and they had black cake.
But chocolate cake is brown.
The icing was black.
Oh. Okay.
So, you know, interesting.
Well, what food trends have you gone for, though? Did you guys try cronuts? What food fads did you go for?
I did have a cronut, and it was pretty fantastic.
I did kale.
Okay. That's the least interesting of all the food fads.
I don't mind certain trends, but food in itself is pretty great. I mean, we're lucky enough to live in a world where we've got just good, actual food that comes from the ground and farms, and why not just actually enjoy it the way it comes to us?
All right, well, here's a thing coming from somebody who is not from the South. Is it possible that Southerners don't go for food trends as much because there's so much about traditional food?
I think there's definitely a lot of truth to that. It wouldn't shock me at all.
Yeah.
That's hard. Yeah, Atlanta's a big transplant city, though. So
that's true enough.
Yeah. For me, I just like my normal colored pizza and keep it simple.
Yeah, but what happens if you had a segment here about turning biscuits black? I mean,
thumbs down.
Yeah. Cornbread.
Yeah.
I don't think people would have very...
No.
What about black fried chicken?
No.
I mean, not necessarily that you've overcooked.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe charred on the barbecue grill, but that's about
charred is one thing. So none of you guys have gone in for food fads, really.
Mm-mm,
what about the cupcake trend?
Yeah, I guess I can say I jumped on board for that. But then, you know, that's like a mini cake to me.
So you were just on for the cake part of it.
That's right.
All right.
Let them eat cake.
Okay. Look, I know that our listeners out there have had more interesting food adventures than our break room panel today. So you need to let us know what food trends you've gone for and which ones lived up to the hype. You know how to reach us. Leave a message at 404-500-9457. Reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. My guests are Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent. Tamika DePriest is marketing and communications strategist. Amber Scott is executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. And Robbie Medwid, Education Director of the Southern Jewish Research Network for Gender and Sexual Diversity. Special thanks to the people who fuel our brains in the morning. Savannah Coffee Roasters donates the coffee that we drink here. They are online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, so look, we all know some relationships don't last. I mean, technically, you're only going to have the one, hopefully, in your life that does last, right? So Everything that's left behind could be some relics and souvenirs, a box full of letters, mixtapes, wedding rings.
Hey, what are you burning, man? Come on.
It's everything. It's everything that reminds me of her, and I need it gone.
Now there is actual place for those relics, the Museum of Broken Relationships in California. It collects items from failed relationships. So what would each of you donate to this museum?
A bad idea. I mean,
really,
I would
why?
Donate nothing. Because I'm like, you know, let it go. I've already
if you start
let
singing,
go.
You're out of it.
Well, I mean, that's what the museum is all about. Let it go. If you haven't already.
Yeah, I guess.
So I've got this old watch from my high school sweetheart that I wow. probably haven't worn since I graduated high school.
One that he gave to you.
Yes, one that he gave to me. And so I donate it.
Okay.
Yeah, I would probably donate my dignity. yeah.
You're going to need that, though.
yeah, I mean, when I break up with someone, it's a clean break. Like, we're done. So within a month or so, it's mostly in the trash. Like, that's over.
I've definitely spent a lot of time. Like, there was one guy I was with that I tried really hard to get into the music that he liked, and I just never could. So I'd definitely get rid of those recordings.
What was the music?
I couldn't even tell you at this point because I'd really tried to get it out of my head. But it was just not at all my style. But I would say, you know, if they could take a picture of me in self-pity with ice cream afterwards, it's probably the
black
best.
Ice cream.
Black ice cream afterwards, right, absolutely.
There's the only time where it's
so Kathy would, and Kathy wouldn't donate anything. This is something we definitely out there for you listening. Tell us what you would donate to the Museum of Broken Relationships. Moving on to something eminently more serious, a letter written by a sexual assault victim to her attacker went viral. A couple weeks ago, the perpetrator was Stanford swimmer Brock Turner. He faced more than 14 years in jail when he was convicted of felony sexual assault. The judge sentenced him to 6 months. Now there's an online petition to remove that judge from the bench. It has, I think at this point, more than 900,000, close to a million signatures. And I wonder if you think he should be forced to step down. One thing I should mention, one other wrinkle, is that what we're seeing in California is that there's a large group of jurors who now refuse to serve in his courtroom as jury, which is, as far as we know, unprecedented. What do we think? Should this judge have to step down?
I think so. I mean, we need to take the public safety and the survivor safety and the impact that that's had should be a lot more important than the impact on the person being accused. So I think if the judge isn't going to enforce a meaningful consequence, then there has to be consequences for him. He needs to be held accountable for that.
I'm kind of conflicted on this because I don't like the precedent of taking a judge out because we don't like the way he ruled. But I think we're also directing all of our anger at the situation towards the judge and not the society and the entire world that created the possibility for this crime to happen
you
in
mean
the first
rape
place.
Culture.
Rape culture, people like boys will be boys, all of those things that we are allowing. How many people are really, you know, the father wrote a letter where he defended his son on getting 20 minutes of action. And that was it. He used that phrase.
He
and
said he shouldn't have to pay what
for
was
his whole life
20,
for 20 minutes
of
action.
Action.
Like the fact that that went on is absolutely disgusting, even more so, I think, than the judge. I think the judge is part of this system, and it's a much, much larger problem than just the judge himself.
I think it was bias operating
on the judge's part?
On the judge's part. I mean, so if you look at some commonalities that's connected to the judge, you know, his profile is similar to, you know,
Brock Turner's.
To Brock Turner's. The Stanford connection, you know, the
athlete
piece. And so, I mean, there's been lots of conversation about judges and bias and the inability to make, you know, the right decisions under such. And so I think he should be recalled as well. And I think that the people are coming together and speaking in a voice that's actually encouraging because there's a lot of work that we have to do around sexual assault education, but also the systems that we have in place to address how we respond and react to them. So it's very complicated.
I have mixed feelings on whether the judge should be recalled, but it's clearly the sentence was not commensurate with the crime. Brock Turner has not taken responsibility for his actions. It doesn't, this whole, I think nobody would say that this sentence makes any sense, and the fact that the kid will probably only serve 3 months total. But I think it's another example of the fact that many people don't take sexual assault seriously on campus and otherwise. And if the victim in this case can't get justice, this is such a clear case.
Yeah, it is such a clear-cut case where if someone is unconscious,
Absolutely.
But that's the whole point, is the judge should be taking it seriously. Like, people don't, but a judge is supposed to be taking it seriously.
I also wonder how many people know that the judge is actually up for re-election this year. I mean, he could be voted on the next few years, but he has no opponent right now. Nobody is running against him for a judge. And
I can't imagine that will last long.
Right. At this point, it has to be a write-in candidate, but that could easily happen where someone else could get elected into his office.
Well, my understanding is he also campaigned when he ran the last time on being a law and order type judge and, you know, being very having stiff penalties. And this doesn't reflect that at all.
And as a former prosecutor who once, you know, whose focus was these kinds of cases. So, go ahead.
What happened?
Recall him.
All right. So social media has exploded with outrage over this particular case. I'm sure if anyone has looked at Twitter or Facebook or anything else, you know about it. But how we vent online is about to change, possibly dramatically. There are new codes of conduct that require Facebook, Google, and others to respond to offensive comments in less than 24 hours. This is coming out of Europe, and the goal is to cut down specifically on hate speech. I wonder, do you think could this work?
I think it's a fool's errand. I hate the amount of hate speech that's on Twitter. I definitely have been a victim of it myself. And I think that Twitter and Facebook and all these groups need to do more for it from themselves. I don't like the idea of any of this coming from the government, though. I definitely have a strong issue with that. But I also think Facebook and Twitter aren't doing their part, period. I know that I've reported certain comments about me, about other people, and Facebook says that does not meet our standards for hate speech. That is not something that we care about.
You've reported to Facebook.
To Facebook and to Twitter. I follow all of the things. I've seen harassment happening, and I report it, and they say that does not
reach
our standards.
Yeah, I've gotten death threats that I reported, and no action was taken either. What do we think? Could this work?
I like it. I think it could work, and I think we can learn from it. Hate speech, you know, as a platform to incite violence or terrorist acts, should be an exception to the First Amendment or linked to the fighting words exception. And I think, you know, because we are in a time where, you know, there's lots of confusion and gray area with that we need some mechanisms to sort of help us as a society deal with it a little bit more aggressively.
Yeah, but I just found the language to be a little bit too vague, because then where does it stop, right?
Afraid it would infringe on free speech.
Exactly. When do we get into the censorship? I mean, I think that when you're getting
death
threats,
who decides?
Who decides what is inciting hate and what is just someone, you know, expressing
ranting
how they feel
or
having the right to do that?
A judge.
What judge do we get? But I mean, okay, here, so we're having a code of conduct to ensure freedom of expression by enacting something that basically curbs free speech. It just, to me, as a free speech person, it just doesn't make sense.
I would like to see fewer threats and you know.
But I think they need to police themselves. I don't think the government.
Oh, the individual corporations.
And I think it needs to be handled on a case-by-case basis and not the government comes in and says.
Making blanket.
We're going to crack down on X, Y, and Z. And who determines, like we said, the extent of what is a problem.
So it is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. My guests are Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent, Robbie Medwed, education director of the Southern Jewish Resource Network for Gender and Sexual Diversity. I'm getting better at that.
Yes,
Amber Scott, executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year, and Tamika DePriest, marketing and communications strategist. So I imagine somebody who had to police Twitter would hate their job. Guess who else does? Doctors. Being a doctor is one of the most respected and highest paying professions, but a career in medicine is not as glamorous as some people think it sounds.
Did you actually just page me to find out how much Tylenol to give to Mrs. Lenzner?
I was worried that it could exacerbate the patient's.
It's regular strength Tylenol. Here's what you do. Get her to open her mouth, take a handful, and throw it at her. Whatever sticks, that's the correct dosage.
Studies show doctors have extremely high levels of psychological distress. A survey by the Physicians Foundation found more than half of doctors would not recommend the profession to their kids. But look, tons of parents push their kids to become doctors. So maybe we should stop doing that?
Well, I don't think you should push your kids to become anything. I mean, I think it's what do you like? What is the child like? What is he interested in? She, because it's not going to, what are they going to do long term? You know, this is going to be a daily job. I know doctors that do not like their jobs, but I know very many doctors who are also satisfied.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think you should push children to do any one thing. And I know growing up, that's what you hear. Doctor, lawyer, you know, is the key job. But I think you should expose kids to a lot of broad career opportunities and their interests, and then also give them that reality. So you want to be a doctor? Let me tell you, that means a 12-hour day. You know, this is kind of the stress that comes with
what
it.
What kind of doctor are you?
You know,
be?
What kind you yes. want to be, and you know, and then let them kind of decide, but have a realistic expectation of what that is really going to look like in your day to day.
But you mean being a doctor's not like being on TV? That's not what actually happens when you work in a hospital.
I was just thinking, you know, I would have liked to have been a doctor, but on TV.
Absolutely. Right. Right. Although on Grey's Anatomy, they
not
die.
Not an emergency room doctor. No, no.
I've never seen a hospital get hit by so many tragedies as on Grey's Anatomy. Okay. You'd think Hollywood would have learned its lesson. We've talked a lot about, you know, Oscars so white. There's been a lot of concern over the lack of diversity and how they keep casting white people to play people of color. But look, news broke this week that a screenwriter who's writing a film featuring the legendary Muslim poet Rumi, Rumi was Afghani, wants Leonardo DiCaprio to play that role. So here's my question. It's been so well publicized. So many important people have complained about this. What does it actually take to get Hollywood to start casting people of color just to play people of color?
It's going to take people behind the camera. You know, it's going to take people of color who are directors, producers, and running studios, obviously, because when you have these many controversies about this and still someone's like, let's just slap a tan on Leonardo DiCaprio and just make it work. You know, I think the challenge is going to have to get people in positions of power to make those decisions and say, that's not acceptable.
Yeah, I think we have to see more people of color actually running studios, running distribution companies that, you know, buy these films. I actually think there's a growing number of people of color who are producing films, documentaries, and content, and finding other ways to distribute it because the infrastructure in Hollywood and those major studios are still ran through basically white male privilege.
I think we also need to get the white actors and all of us who are white to
refuse.
To know that, right, we need to refuse. We need to step back. We need to say, you know what, this is not right for me right now. Here are five actors that I know who would be much better for this part. I'll take the next one.
Well, and the interesting thing is this writer, these people that are involved, David Franzoni, he says, I wanted to challenge the stereotypic portrayal of this Muslim character in Western cinema by making this movie, but then by casting Leonardo DiCaprio, that just makes absolutely no sense.
Maybe he's thinking people like Leonardo DiCaprio, and so they want to make.
I think he's thinking of making money. People will come to see that film.
I don't believe that people will only come to see it if it's Leonardo DiCaprio. I feel like they'd come to see if it was a good movie, but that's just me, and maybe my journalism hasn't hammered every bit of optimism out of my system yet. We have one last thing, and it's going to have to be a lightning round because we only got about 90 seconds to cover it. Georgia's movie industry is booming. That's a help, of course, from the state's generous tax cuts. We see the landscapes featured prominently, movies like The Hunger Games, Anchorman 2, but you can submit a picture of your home to the Georgia Department of Economic Development if you want them to shoot a film at your house. Who would do this?
I would do it. Absolutely.
Everyone?
Maybe. I would do it.
I would do it if they brought a cleaning crew in. What if it's a movie you hated?
I don't know. I'd have to see what it was and how many people are they bringing into my house and my neighborhood. So it would depend. Yes.
I mean, they're not going to make the movie. It's not. If it's about me, that's a separate thing. But if it's just some movie renting my house and giving me money for it, I can go stay in a hotel for a few days. I don't mind.
Could be like a gangster movie where they splash fake blood all over your
walls. As long as it comes back to me clean, I don't mind.
Along with the paycheck. And if I like the script, a cameo.
Yeah, I'd do it if it was Idris Elba would be in my house.
Oh, see, now that's a difference.
If that's the route we're going, I got a list.
I'm coming over.
Right.
I'm coming over.
Don't look at me, Kathy. I have no control over these people.
I'm like, what?
We don't need to get started on Robbie's list. We are out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all of my guests. Kathy Lohr is a former NPR correspondent and journalist. Tamika DePriest, marketing and communications strategist. Amber Scott, executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. And Robbie Medwed, education director of the Southern Jewish Research Network for Gender and Sexual Diversity. That's a show for today. But here, that question goes out to all of you out there listening. Would you let them film a movie in your home? And would it depend on what kind of movie it is? I mean, maybe it's controversial content that you would not want to have your house associated with. Anyway, call us and tell us what you think at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today and the week that is On Second Thought from GPB News, I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.
Our house, it has a crowd. There's always something happening, and it's usually quite loud. Our mum, she's so house proud. Nothing ever slows her down, and a mess is not allowed.